Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Well, as you know, one of the persistent themes that we like to talk about is the reality of the made object. And to that end, today we're going to be speaking with Guy Martin, who is a digital fabricator. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here. Sorry if I'm just getting over the flu, so I have to apologize for that in advance.
Well, I'll try to have it yes or no questions, you know. Cough once for yes.
Yeah. And also, it's Guy. I come from a French-speaking family in Louisiana, so we still...
Oh, I'm sorry, Guy.
Oh, that's fine.
Guy Martin. All right.
Yeah.
My Cajun is extremely deficient. I'm terribly sorry.
No, it's fine.
So, you were introduced to me by Guy Horton,
uh-huh.
And I was reading this WordPress piece that you put out, which I thought was really, really, really great, where you say, I see the early era of digital craft we are in as being stuck in this phenomenon whereby we use new tools to make things that were originally made by old tools. Mm-hmm. And... So I wanted to start out by just asking you about how you got into this new, brave new world of digital fabrication and what your background is. I know you've written somewhat about the craftsmanship of Stradivarius, which means that you have an appreciation, certainly a keen appreciation for really fantastic fabrication. And I also want to note that here in the studio, we have two graduate architects, friends of ours, Mark Canfield and Ryan Doyle, and they are very interested in this 3D digital world, and so they may chime in with some questions for you, Guy.
Okay, that's great.
So, well, if you can, if you have the voice for it, tell me, how did you get into this sort of work?
It's probably kind of a long-winded story. Kind of at the bridge between the two influences in my life, my parents. My dad was a structural engineer, and my mother was a painter. So I've always bounced between those two sort of worlds. And growing up, grew up in New Orleans, and we moved to overseas to Dubai when that whole thing was starting off. So I got to experience a lot of firsthand fabrication by seeing it happen. By being in the fabrication yard. And that sort of just continued through my life. I was always making things. Started architecture school and actually started being more interested in the realization of the design. So I spent a lot of time in the shop. Started a furniture line in Louisiana. And just I kept always striving to, connect more with the making, the materials, and what they could teach me. And then I started getting more involved in CNC fabricating as part of architectural facades or some of the furniture, and got involved in an early design software suite, which was called SDRC. It's now owned by EDS. It's called Unigraphics. So that was one of the very first sort of parametric modelers.
Uh-huh.
And I just kept following this path between CNC and CAD-CAM as an extension of the hand, and also by also trying to perfect the hand at the same time. So we're walking between those two worlds.
By hand, are you meaning hand tools like
yes, I mean I guess I've always tried to operate it like what the very new can provide us, but also being very grounded in the very old. So using hand planes to shape wood and, mm-hmm. Just like learning that sanding is an actually intricate thing and you have to do it a certain way. And, By working with wood, the wood's going to provide us with a certain resistance or a certain material property that's going to inform, you know, inform design.
Yeah, yeah. I think of materials as our best friends because they tell us how they want to be fashioned.
Yeah.
So, well, one of the things that interests me in this bridge period between handcraft and digital handcraft, because there's a lot of handcraft, even though you're doing digital fabrication, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're still hand finishing.
Mm-hmm.
It is an issue of resolution, a kerf that you might cut in a piece of wood with a hand tool could be incredibly precise, more so than a CNC tool, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things that come out of CNC routing or 3D printing, and the guys here in the studio are very interested in 3D printing. Did you get the 3D printing in the studio yet?
We didn't get the 3D printing yet.
Oh, no, okay. It is for me, it is an issue of resolution. I mean, you still see the jaggies, you know, because it's not a perfect craft yet.
Yeah.
Now, do you have some of these really big numeric code operating machines in your shop?
Yeah, we have a couple of CNC machines. One's a smaller, like a gantry mill. And our main machine is a robotic CNC where we can mill stuff up to 50 feet in length. And I think the tallest part we've ever milled was about 17 feet in height.
Wow.
And about 13 feet deep. And then we also have a surface plate that is in the work cell. So, and also it's set up for doing robotic standing and paste deposition and also fiberglass chopper gun spraying.
Wow. Well, you've got the whole thing going there.
Yeah.
So what is the resolution, you know, of fineness of stepping that you've got in any of those machines?
Well, with the robot, you have, its repeatability is down to 0.1 millimeters.
Wow.
But then you also have issues of robots have a little bit of a force that, you know, when they're milling, say if they're pushing against a hard, dense material, say like a 40-pound foam, they're going to have a certain amount of pushback.
Yeah.
So you have to, you know, account for these sort of things when you're milling. You can't just let it, you know, you can't just push the button and say go and not be accountable for like the effect on the machine or like cycle times. I mean, we could let the machine run for days on end at a very
Is that what you guys are cutting mostly, is foam?
We cut everything from EPS foam, 2-pound EPS foam, up to like 40, 50-pound epoxy foams and some aluminum.
Interesting.
And also the robot has somewhat of a cyclical effect when it's cutting, because it has, on the robot alone, there's 6 axes versus like 3 axes in a gantry mill.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a bit of a surface effect on the final finish. So you have to take into account like how accurate you are when you're programming it and how fast your feet.
Is that when you guys go back through and sand it out with hand, by a hand tool, or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what I guess I was trying to get at, is that, you know, we could run it extremely precise and extremely fine step over, but the amount of time that it takes to do that, it's warrants to basically take it off the machine and process it by hand at that point.
Oh, so that's cool. So it's like a 2-step process. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or would you use a robotic sander, possibly?
That we usually use when it's like a repetitive part. And then we're using it to get close to the final finish. It's an intermediate step.
Uh-huh.
So we'll come back with the final. It might be like, you know, 120 grit or 220 grit, and then we come back up to, like, say, 600 by hand.
Uh-huh.
because of the cyclical nature of the robot, it's easier to...
easier by hand to do walk around more, something, you have
that
angle.
You have that feedback loop.
Yeah.
That when you're, you can see the visuals of it when you're standing at that precise.
Absolutely.
And feel it with your hand. So you can... To get the robot to that stage on a part that's going to be one or two pieces, it's much more labor intensive to get the robot to the state to where it can replicate your hand,
right, or your eye.
Yeah.
You spoke about surface effects that happen. What are the surface effects?
Well, the robot is more of a polar motion because you have rotary axes. Versus right. Linear axes. So when all the, you have six different axes that are working simultaneously to position your tool. Mm-hmm. So depending on the speed and accuracy of each of those axes, it can create sort of a cyclical cut. It's a very, very fine detail. But if you push your hand over it, you can feel a bit of a cyclical motion. You'll see, like, over time, it's almost like a cycloid. Like if you took a circle and stuck a pen in it and rolled it across a distance, and it'll have that sort of cyclical motion where at points it'll have a little bit more pressure.
Oh, you mean the kind of. Pattern you'd get from the old-fashioned spirograph,
yeah.
Or see, I'm more comfortable with flat finishes. What I'm thinking is that it imparts a kind of finish like the one that we used to see on certain kinds of industrial equipment, which was called jiggered nickel. You probably know that one,
yeah.
In the old days used to be very difficult for them to create. I guess it would be pretty easy now.
Yeah.
So, can you 40-pound foam? Can you sand that stuff?
One of the types of foam. I mean, it's technically a foam, but if you hit it with your fist, you would break your fist. It's a two-part epoxy that we use. It's extruded through an extremely high-pressure machine, and then it mixes at the tip. We have a applicator that's on the end of the robot. And so the two epoxies with fillers come together and then they cure. There's a product called Ren Board. A lot of people use that for high-definition models. And basically the paste, we can apply it over very large areas without having to block it up with blocks of the sheets of that foam. So, like on an aerospace project, what we'll do is undercut, then apply this material, let it cure, and then we're only off maybe, say, a millimeter or two. So we just come back and rough cut that off and then do the finish cut. And then it can serve as a direct mold or a very, very durable master.
Hmm. Then you're laying down other materials over it, like... Well, you're making a mold, and then you're putting something over that becomes a shell-like material that you can lift off again and again and finish.
Yeah. Traditionally you'd make a fiberglass mold. With this, we can go directly to the mold by machining the mold.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's really. I can see my guys here in the studio. Their heads are spinning with ideas of like, what could we a machine like this to do in terms of making parts of buildings. I want to talk about what kinds of commissions you've had. Is it just aerospace? But let's take a little 2-minute musical break and then reframe our thoughts and come back, all right?
Okay.
Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. We're talking with Guy Martin, who is a digital and hand fabricator. Where are you located?
We're in Westminster. It's just north of Huntington Beach, California, right along the glorious 405.
Wow, okay. That's surfing country, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, we're about 15 minutes from the beach.
Yeah, oh, man, that's tough. Wow. I grew up on the Jersey Shore, and I did surfing, but, you know, a good surf run lasts about 3 minutes in Jersey. Beaches are too steep.
Yeah.
So are you, you mentioned aerospace. I know there's plenty of aerospace in California. Is that your main focus, or what industry?
Well, I mean, architecture is the main focus. I graduated from SciArc back in 2006, but just because of the ups and downs of the architecture market, we branched out to do other, service other industries. And also, you know, there's also a learning process that when we do those projects, we can pull that sort of knowledge and technology back into the architectural projects. But we've worked with like companies like SpaceX, some smaller subcontractors. We've done stuff for Disney. We've done some stuff for some of the entertainment industry. Like we did some planes for the Green Lantern film. We've done a bunch of work for Philippe Starck. We did the Taschen bookstores in New York and Los Angeles, a project for them in Boston. A large project for some column cladding in Miami, the Icon Brickell project.
Oh, yeah.
So it's fairly diverse.
Now, all of this gear is capital intensive. I mean, you must have lucked into some pretty nice commissions to be able to afford that.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the projects, we had a smaller studio before we moved here in about 2007, and then we had some really big projects in 2007, 2008 that allowed for, that expansion.
We're looking at some pictures of the Taschen New York bookstore here. What did you do for them?
It's in the second level. It's in the offices downstairs. There's the these bronze columns.
Uh-huh.
It's a metallized, cold sprayed, metallized column. And then the exterior signage.
Was that a Philippe Starck project?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. How do you like working with the Starck organization?
Actually, they're really great to work with. They give you a lot of leeway and allow a lot of input from you. Sometimes we'll do something where they give us a model that, say, one of their sculptors have worked on, and we'll laser scan that and then, modify it to the condition.
Well, that's
fair shop drawings and then go from there. But sometimes it's, they give us a napkin sketch. And, we develop the models, like for the project in Boston, they basically just gave us a very loose napkin sketch. So, we had a lot of input into the surfaces, the model itself.
So a metallized finish. So was that your fiberglass blower chopper robot thing going on there?
No. It's a secondary operation. It's actually a metal in a binder that we apply on top of the fiberglass substrate, and then since it's made out of the base metals, we can polish it, patina it, and it acts pretty much like the base metal. That it's just a thin coating versus a whole casting.
Mm-hmm. I myself am lost in images of what might be possible. Mm-hmm. The within the architectural field, much of what about a quarter of what we do actually involves components that have to be on the outside of a building.
Yeah.
So the things that you would be working on, how weatherized are they? How do they hold up with UV and things like that?
It's basically you just choose the materials that are going to tone or those effects. I mean, if you look at composites, I mean, you know, a huge percentage of planes now are made of composites.
Yeah.
Boats. I mean, all these things that stand out in the weather. You just you have to be very selective about the materials that you're using. But some of the, you know, the epoxies and the components are very, very durable and corrosion resistant.
I'm more concerned about ultraviolet.
Yeah, there's ultraviolet inhibitors that you put in certain, like gel coats or finishes.
Right.
Like the metallized finish, I mean, it's basically just the metal finish itself. You know, it's not going to, it's going to oxidize if you leave it exposed, but it's not going to degrade from UV.
Have you found materials that are recycled
that you can use? Why don't you use Mark's mic here?
Have you found recycled materials that you can use?
Sometimes, well, depending on the project, we, you know, we can incorporate some of the waste that we have and use a binder and put it back into the product. That, unfortunately, right now it's still at the point where we can use some recyclable, like, say, foams, but it's always a cost issue that whether or not the project can support it. You know, we try to. We recycle all our materials, almost all the materials in the shop.
How big is your organization?
It depends on the project. Can flow anywhere from 5 to 35.
Wow.
Depending on the project.
And is it just the one location you have there in Westminster?
Yeah, we have about a 18,000 square foot facility here.
Mm.
And we have all the in Southern California, you have to have permits to, you know, do the fiberglass work. So we're fully permitted and have spray booths and all the sort of secondary facilities for taking the project all the way through.
So while we're having our very brief little break, one of the guys here, you know, remarked on this huge big thing that you did was 17 feet deep and
50 feet
long. What was that material that you milled?
Well, that was a payload fairing.
Wow.
For an aerospace project. And it was basically made a steel, trussed steel armature. And then it had a plywood on top of that. And then we applied a medium-density foam and then extruded the tooling paste on top of that. So it was the basis to make, carbon fiber tool for the aerospace industry.
Yeah, well, a fairing is a cowl that's shaped to be aerodynamic, right?
Yeah, it was basically the part that sat on top of the rocket where they, you know, where they put satellites and those kind of...
That's so cool. That is... absolutely extraordinary. Do you sign your work on the inside?
No, I thought about it. Kilroy was here. that, unfortunately, I wouldn't have passed the tolerance.
You need a hologram.
Yeah.
Our mutual friend Guy Horton encourages me to ask you about your love of banjo playing, and I'm thinking that an appreciation for a really fine stringed instrument would get you launch you into an appreciation for the kind of work that you're doing.
Yeah, actually, I grew up. It's a fiddle. My grandfather played the fiddle, so I've always loved it, and I never really thought that I was musical until about 3 years ago. And a client came by, and he always heard, you know, Creole and Cajun music in the shop. And when I finished the project, he brought by a fiddle, and I just started picking it up from there, and I've been playing for about 3 years now. I play a Cajun band, and we play at some of the festivals around here. But it's, you know, it's that thing where I'm always trying to come back to some real tactile system that's going to give me that response that, you know, that I seek in the material, and that this kind of elicits that same process. It's you know, the feel of it is very important, not just the technicality of it.
Well, my apologies for imputing that you were a banjo player.
No, that's fine.
I had misread the email. I have a musical question in Cajun fiddle playing. Do you play at the chin position, or do you play it with the butt of the or the bottom end of the fiddle against your chest, the way that some Eastern contraband dancing masters will play and call tunes at the same time.
Yeah, it's probably somewhere in between. I mean, it's not like a classical where it's very, you know, right angle to you on your shoulder.
Uh-huh.
It's more on your chest, but it's not as far down. It's not like mid torso.
Uh-huh.
It's probably like up on your chest.
Okay, so somewhere between your shoulder and your pecs.
Yeah.
Well, you'd get real good feedback in that position, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's just incredible the resonance that you get from the instrument.
Yeah, I was just thinking. Yeah, I mean, I have a dinky little Martin backpack guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds totally terrible until you hold it against your body, and then your entire body becomes a resonator.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, it's like, wow, this thing just woke up.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that makes perfect sense in terms of what your interest in terms of feedback loops and bridging the gap between something that's totally analog, like hand sanding.
Mm-hmm.
And the digital world. I want to talk a little bit more about where you think this is going to go in the future. Joe, could we have another couple minutes of musical break? Some analog music by George Naha, who was a guest here about 2.5 months ago. George is a jazz guitarist, and he started out being my classmate in architecture school. We're speaking with Guy Martin, who's a digital and analog fabricator. Where does this go? I mean, I see parametricism being, Guy being held up as like the next new style. To me, it's just it's a technology.
Yeah.
What do you think about?
Well, I mean, I think it's really interesting. Again, I got involved in it maybe 15, at least more than 15 years ago. But I mean, at its base, it's basically just a geometric operator. It doesn't, a lot of times, at this state, I don't believe that it has that feedback loop. It's not telling you, you know, you don't have material resistances embedded in the software that's telling you, like, you know, this bend is not going to work. I mean, you can do it on a geometric level, but not
right.
On a material level.
Yes.
and oftentimes, you can just go through the iterative process of, you know, transforming a surface and manipulating it in a certain way and just keep following that operation. You can do it analog. I mean, you can do it in an analog way without using the parametric drivers. I mean, I think in one way it's an interesting thing, but I don't believe it has the richness that it's not allowing for that feedback loop that's going to surprise you. It's not going to tell you that the material can't work in this way or wants to work this way, and it's going to, move the way you design it.
Right, exactly. I mean, so you could make almost any shape.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing in topological surfaces, and you can twist them in all three axes.
It's a frictionless space.
Right. But it doesn't mean that the form that you're making has any inherent structural stability.
Yeah.
It's not telling you, it's not giving you a feedback on whether or what or how much ribbing needs to be added to the back of the surface, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do the designers that you work with handle that? Do they stress test these shapes?
Sometimes, you know, basically a lot of people love to do FEA, perhaps because it creates these stunning images. But
What is that? DFEA, what is that?
A finite element analysis.
Oh, okay.
You know, where you break the surface or the structure down into nodes, and then it analyzes each node. But what I mean, that's from an engineering perspective. That's another operation that you put on the parametric driver. But what I'm really interested in is being able to work digitally in the same way that a sculptor goes out in the studio and starts dealing with stone or wood and has this feedback that comes from the material. But, you know, you have sort of a top-down idea that might be parametric. It's very linear, but it doesn't allow for that iterative process that makes, say, a secondary or a tertiary level of design within the primary design. It doesn't generate additional richness.
It almost has something to do with introducing the like kind of possibility for chance or like mistakes to take place within the making of something that allows you to then create things you didn't anticipate.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, because a milling machine doesn't tell you that the grain of the wood doesn't like the way that it's being shredded until, I guess, you have a failure or something.
You're watching it, yeah.
Well, yeah, because there's certain parts of the wood that are softer than other parts.
Yeah.
You have to deal with, tear out. You might want the bit to be run in a different direction in certain areas of the grain.
I'm curious about these bits. Now, I've seen videos of CNC routers, and they had, Fournier bits that were just doing stupid, you know, just rotary shaving down and up. Are the milling bits that you're using like a golf ball?
I mean, we have a variety of bits. I mean, we have bits that are as big as like 3 inches wide that have like index inserts in them.
Is like a 3 or 2 bit process? Do you guys do like a bigger one than
it would? Yeah, you have to rough it, get rid of the excess material, then you slowly come down to the finish path.
Mm-hmm. But if you're working in the six axes, mm-hmm. which anybody who's a pilot understands, I would think that you're not using a basically planar bit, but it would have to be an orbital bit, a ball. No.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're thinking about in six axis, a lot of times you can do like what's called swarf cuts, where you take the entire length of the bit and you stroke that along the surface instead of just using the tip of the bit. And that's something that five axis and six axis milling affords versus three axis. Mm-hmm. Three axis, you only have the tip of the bit, and you're running it, you know, in a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So you can think about using the bit, especially if it's like a ruled surface. You can use, say, a 12-inch bit and sculpt the entire surface in one pass.
Mm.
Versus, you know, spending hours and hours and hours doing it just from the tip.
Well, a 12-inch bit is what, like a 12-inch long cylindrical rasp?
Well, it's a fluted bit, so it'd be the length of cut would be anywhere from 10 to 12 inches. So the fluting, which is sharp, goes around the bit.
Got it.
So you have like two flutes, you have four flutes. like if you look at a typical router bit, it's just usually a straight flute.
Okay.
So this is like a helix that goes around the shaft.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good for ejecting the material that you're removing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Now, could you use... I'm always looking for a practical application because, I'm a technician, an architectural technician, and I'm thinking, well, could Guy make forms for precast for us?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is that a yes?
Yeah, we've made precast forms before, and like especially like if it's a ruled surface, that's when we use like a swarf cut to cut down on time, or use like a wire cutter. But we've made precast forms for concrete. Sometimes it's just like a form liner that you would stick inside of a form. Sometimes it's the actual EPS foam that you cast inside of that and rip the foam off.
What's the maximum depth you guys have done that for concrete?
Probably not too deep, maybe like two and a half.
Yeah, it gets heavy, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, Guy, if you were going to replicate ornament, say, I mean, since you went to architecture school, this is not a out-of-the-ballpark question you should know about. If someone came to you and said, I need you to replicate Louis Sullivan's ornament at the Carson Peary Scott department store, and somebody had done a 3D scan and had a digital, you know, file that captured all of that hand carving that had been done, could you replicate that?
Could if it was for the project. I probably wouldn't want to replicate it for another project.
Well, no, I'm just saying technically that could be replicated.
Yes, yeah. But and a lot of that starts getting involved in like how do you cut it so that you're doing a very minimal amount of handwork afterwards, so you can be authentic to the original.
Right.
So you know that requires a lot of knowledge of like types of cutting. You know, you're not just doing all three axis cuts.
Right. But there are some things that the machine probably can't do. I'm supposing.
Well, it's also a lot of times, like when we're talking about the sanding, the robot gets you, or that technology might get you to where you're only having 10% of the labor. So you come back and you put all the finishing touches on it that is very difficult, or very very timely for the robot to do. I mean, you know, we have bits that are like half a millimeter thick.
Wow.
And we could capture, you know, extreme detail, but it's going to take, you know, a long amount of time to render that detail.
Yeah, but you have to drive that bit very carefully because it's so slender.
Yeah.
Right.
So a lot of times, you know, what we'll do is use tool paths, like the directionality of the tool path will have lines that can indicate, you know, the direction of, say, the chisel that we have to come and finish it with, or the sand bit. So a lot of times we'll use tool paths to indicate, like, how to finish.
Pardon me for appearing stupid. What's a tool path?
Well, the tool path is basically just, you know, when you generate how the tool is going to be cutting or spraying or whatever the tool is going to be doing, you have a pattern, a geometric pattern that's laid on top of the geometry. And the tool follows that.
All right. Well, what I was thinking in terms of what machines can't do, and maybe they can, but I don't... a few days ago, and I don't know if you've been to New York City anytime recently, but in Manhattan, we're talking to you from Brooklyn, and Brooklyn is not Manhattan, so we have to be careful here. But over in Manhattan at the Metropolitan Museum, there is a Greco-Romano wing, and they have this gigantic column with a Corinthian capital. And there are spaces behind some of the acanthus leaves in this capital that were cut out by hand, and I don't think a machine could probably get in there.
Mm-hmm.
Deep recesses, unless it was a multi-part assembly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That frequently happens. We'll do like a cut that has deep undercuts that we can only get so far in, and then you have to take the rest of it by hand.
Uh-huh. Cool.
So, I mean, that's, we're sort of at this area where people, you know, have the conception that it's just like a direct print for a lot of this. But the reality is that there is an incredible amount of handwork and technical skills that get it to that, you know, very fine level.
Right, the finish, yeah.
Now, so your shop is not getting into 3D printing yet, right?
Not small. I mean, we are using a sort of hybrid system where we do the paste deposition.
The what?
Then we come back and mill that.
The what?
The tooling paste.
Uh-huh.
So we can deposit that as like the understructure instead of blocking up a bunch of foam.
Okay, and that's your chopped fiberglass overlay mix.
Yeah, it's a two-part. It's very viscous epoxy.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then we'll come back and mill that. So it saves us a step from having to build up a huge block and extract the form from that huge block.
So right. It's like a liquid, and then it hardens, and then you...
Yeah. It's incredibly viscous paste. It's like cold peanut butter. we deposit that basically like almost like you would coil a ceramic work. So it's a near net shape. It's close to what we're going to, maybe like 2 or 3 millimeters off from the finished surface. So then we come back and just mill that back.
Uh-huh. So, Guy, are there certain shapes that are ideal for this kind of technology, for this fabrication technology, and other shapes that are not ideal?
There's shapes that are, like, if it's a very ruled shape, that can be created in a traditional manner that has, you would basically create sections, lofts, and then you would build wood planking over it, and then you could get your formwork off of that.
Right.
I think what it lends itself to is more intricate and more more figurative, more detailed work, and work that has to have a certain amount of repeatability. Most of the big projects that we've done the geometry is very intricate. There's no other way you could really replicate it effectively. And we're building it here. We're shipping it, say, to Miami, and we have to piece it together, and it has to be, within, 20 thousandths of an inch for it to go together properly.
Have you guys ever thought about doing curtain wall stuff, like applying any of this to a facade of a building?
Yeah. A part of it is just regulation issues. Part of the reason why composites haven't made a huge inroads into buildings yet is because, we're sort of based on the model of like the load resistance factor design.
Because it's an interesting idea because it's light, it's foam.
Yeah.
So it would be...
Yeah, but it's flammable.
Right. Okay.
Well, there's material. You can make it non-flammable.
Well, that's good to know.
Depending on what selection of resin, but right now, they're slowly passing codes in the building codes that allow the manufacturer to certify the strength, the load, the fire resistance of the material in the assembly.
Yes,
because before, an engineer can look up a section, an I-beam. In the steel manual and say, this is going to perform, it's going to have this much capacity.
Right, but you're doing bespoke forms,
yeah.
And there's no ASTM for that form, and it comes down to the model itself, and unless someone wants to do your DFE analysis on it, there's no documentation, right?
Yeah. But it's... the codes are starting to allow the manufacturer to be the one that certifies all that. So I see more of an inroads in the future. I mean, if you look, you look abroad, there's, I think there was a huge tower, a huge dome that was made in Bahrain. There's a Zaha Hadid project that was made with carbon fiber. It's mainly a code issue at this point.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Zaha Hadid, whether you'd worked on any of her projects.
No, I haven't.
Oh, good.
So that leads me to another question I've had, an interest I've had in these 3D fabrication tools that I think it relates to codes and other municipal regulations is, I guess like one example would be plumbing fixtures. You know, like what is stopping you from making, you know, a toilet, making a sink, making that integrated into a wall panel assembly? It would seem like it's the sort of regulations in place, that, you know, the MEA numbers, UL listings, mm-hmm. particularly in a place like New York that you have to have certified, so-and-so has made
this. I like
this.
That idea, Ryan.
You know,
that's
but
good.
For me, that, you know, and when we're talking about making buildings, a lot of the one of the issues I think we've run into in the last 50 or so years is that we're slowly piecing together these buildings out of very disparate systems. You know, there's a whole electrical component, heating, ventilation, cooling, plumbing systems that are all these different pieces, and we all just sort of slap them behind walls, hide things in different places so you can't see them. It seems like if we're in the process now where we can control how we make these things, why not make it part of the wall, that the toilet and the sink and all is all one thing? Again, it's a whole other, you know, maintenance issue.
So
down
Ryan,
the road,
you would like the fabricators to actually be doing the plumbing parts?
Why not? I mean, I'd like to own the equipment to make every part of the building myself. You know, it'd be really fascinating.
Well, I mean, that's you know, that's something we're really interested in, and that's why, like with the robot, it's not just about the forms itself. We have surface plates that can assure continuity between each process. Mm-hmm. So we can build a fixture, make a form, mill out the form, spray it, you know, with a robot with fiberglass, send it to another department, have, you know, say wiring or whatever put in, mm-hmm. come back to the robot, have another process done on it. So, I mean, you know, I'm really interested in looking at the robot as part of the whole process, mm-hmm. not just making that one step in say, milling.
Gee, I have a stupid question. What's a surface plate?
A surface plate is basically just, I mean, traditionally, like you would see them in shops, like a milling shop, where it's just a extremely flat plate. So if it's basically your datum line. So if you want to take measurements off of it, or you want to take tooling balls and you know, put your fixture in it, you can take your fixture off and go somewhere else and do something to it and bring it back, and you know that every step in the process is going to be completely flat. That datum is going to be continuous.
Okay. That good to know.
So, like, you know, I
only ask that because you're educating us.
Yeah.
And these guys are going to be calling the shots in 30 years or less. And, you know, and I want to know because I'm going to still be around in 30 years. And these are obviously terms that we need to know in order mm-hmm. to be able to communicate with people like you mm-hmm. or with you about things that we would like fabricated.
Yeah.
Now, how often do you actually have a dialogue with an architect?
It depends on the project. I mean, we like to get involved early on so that we're not just coming in and, you know, resolving a certain issue, but we can figure out what the design intent is.
Right. I mean, the question was how often. Is it often, not often, infrequent?
It depends on the architect. sometimes I would like it to be more. I would really like it to be more often, instead of the afterthought. Because I think that's a big strength that we can bring. You know, by bringing that whole process and feedback loop into it, we can realize the design to perhaps maybe a higher level.
So what I'm hearing you say is that the earlier the conversation, the better the result.
Yeah.
We've heard that before. Our friends at Shop Architects have mm-hmm. gone way off into CAD/CAM.
Yeah.
And they've had some interesting successes.
Mm-hmm.
That is their philosophy.
Yeah.
By the way, guys. All right. Let's take another couple minutes break and then have any last thoughts, all right?
Yeah.
Burning Down the House with Guy Martin, who is a 3D and analog fabricator, and we've come close to the end of our allotted time here. Guy, what would you like us architects to know about the limitations or possibilities of these fabrication technologies that you use and that you have?
Patience. It's always probably, you know, that sort of time cost issue. probably the greatest limitation. But, you know, a lot of times, as we were saying before, if we get involved early on in the project, you know, we can look, because perhaps maybe the architect is working in a different, you know, they're coming from a different perspective, or we have sort of maybe a combined perspective of the design and also what it's going to take to realize it. You know, it's sort of that issue where, you know, when you're a very young architect, because you can draw something in AutoCAD to, you know, a couple hundred thousandths degree accuracy, you give somebody on the shop floor a drawing that says, you know, this, we went to this accuracy and there's no way of doing that. It's kind of a bad example, but...
No, but that speaks to, Guy, that speaks to the issue of discernment.
Yeah.
Which is not taught in architecture schools.
And knowing when, where to put your effort, and knowing where too much effort is not going to give you what you're seeking. So, you know, when we can come in early in the project, then we can have the ability to say and work closely with the architect, okay, this is what is very important about your design intent, and this is, you know, where we're going to strive to work. And we're not going to, you know... That's the importance of it, and not being overly discerned about something that's not going to be visible or not pay off.
So what I hear you say is that if you get drawings from an architect, what you'd like to see is what is the design intent, and a little bit less of how the architect thinks it goes together. Yes?
Exactly. Yeah. I think if we can come about it as a collaborative effort, it's a much richer project, and I think the process flows.
You know... when you were in architecture school, Guy, did anyone introduce you to Christopher Alexander's A Pattern Language?
Yes. Didn't really study it an extensive amount. I was really interested in, like, stereoatomic projection, those sort of issues.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I found in there, and I was just recently reintroduced to it, and I actually bought a copy, was where Alexander's crew... said that a mark of the novice is try to work out everything in advance. And the mark of a masterwork is to allow the possibility for collaborative problem solving later on.
Yeah.
So would you you'd each sign on for that, yeah?
Yes, I'd fully put myself in that camp.
Very good. guys,
and,
here
and
in this
again, that's like when we got back to the sort of parametric trend right now. It's still like a top-down thing, and it doesn't afford that sort of go back and forth that I find very rich.
So do I. Guys in the studio, have any last things to say to Guy?
No, very impressive work. Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
Well, we've come to the end of another episode of Burning in the House with Guy Martin, who's a digital fabricator in Westminster, California. Guy, do you have any URLs that you'd like to flog for our
We have the main Guy at GuyMartinDesign.com.
And you also have a blog,
WordPress,
right?
GuyMartinDesign.wordpress.com.
Okay.
A blog we just started.
Excellent. And are you working on any projects that we might see in the New York area anytime soon?
Not in New York. We're working on a restaurant project right now in Los Angeles.
Okay, so those of you who are listening from the West Coast, or the Left Coast of the United States, where's that going to be?
It's on Fairfax. It's the guys from Animal and Ludovic Lefebvre. It's going to be called Trois Mec, and it's a really small restaurant. We're doing very sort of organic furniture for it.
Uh huh. That sounds totally parametric. Oh my God! Oh, the walls are melting, dude. Don't take two tabs. Okay. thank you, Guy. Thank you so much for joining us, despite your recovering from the flu. I'm terribly sorry about that.
That's fine.
This has been
Thank
Burning
you
so
Down. I enjoyed participating.
I hope that you might participate again soon.
Sounds good.
You're a fabulous resource, and we will remember to call you when we've got our next project.
Great.
All right. This has been Burning Down the House with Guy Martin, talking about 3D fabrication, analog, digital, everything good, with Ryan Doyle, Mark Canfield. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith. You know, this is...
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.